You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, where you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for May 24th, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just behind the Lindsey Graham one-man anti-gay pride parade, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Lindsey Graham decides that he can't change the definition of marriage in the immigration bill.
Yeah, so we'll shoot that down.
Shoot that down right now. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats went along with it, and I don't know what kind of choice they had.
This is such a good civics lesson.
It is. It is.
Blue Gal, back in the old days, we had a thing in this country called politics. I'm going to talk like Hal Holbrook doing Mark Twain now.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Now, back in my day, we had a thing called politics, Blue Gal, and it involved compromise, and everybody involved was assholes, but I got shit done. And frankly, first of all, I'd like to know, has any reporter ever asked Lindsey Graham if he's gay?
I don't know.
I don't know either, and that's a really weird question, because it's like the most open of all open secrets in mm-hmm, Washington, mm-hmm. that Lindsey Graham is a deeply closeted gay man mm-hmm. who is a senator from a deeply homophobic, backwards-ass red state mm-hmm. and has made his political career on the kind of hyper-military, hyper-patriotism, hyper-self-loathing
yep.
that would break a normal man. but he's built his career on it. And now that his state, you know, is swirling around the toilet bowl of red state tea partyism, he has to keep moving further and further to the right.
To avoid being teabagged, which is very ironic. Yes.
And I know people always wink and nod about this, but
they openly laugh about it on Morning Joe.
Yeah.
I mean, just crack them up.
But has any reporter ever asked him, are you straight or are you gay?
Not that.
And I don't care about your activities
or not. Yeah.
Or are you celibate? Are you not? Are you none of the above? Are you bisexual? I don't particularly care, but it is weird to me that this sort of central character in all of these dramas, mm-hmm. especially ones that impinge on gay rights, which are, let's face it, civil rights, human rights that shouldn't be the province of anyone, but it does involve a specific group being told you can't be fully human in our culture.
Right.
Asking a person who appears to be a member of that group, are you a member of that group? And if not, who was the last woman you dated?
Yeah.
And if I'm sorry if you think that's an inappropriate question, I think voting on other people's civil rights is inappropriate too. So let's just agree.
Well, and I mean, even if you don't want to go the sexuality route, a person who has never been married standing up on a soapbox and saying, I refuse to change the definition of marriage
mm-hmm.
is a bit ironic. And
unless that person's wearing
a question.
Unless that person is wearing a red beanie and red Prada shoes and has been elevated to that position by God
and
himself.
Signed because he's going to get in so much trouble if he doesn't quit. Yes. Yeah.
I don't, as a liberal and as a privacy, libertarian in that sense, I don't care who anybody's sleeping with or if they're sleeping with anybody at all. I care deeply if your personal life is in direct conflict with your public policy making in a way that actively harms people who otherwise would be part of your group.
Speaking of Anthony Weiner.
Yes. Weiner's back, baby.
Might as well switch to him since we're talking about such things.
Yeah.
And Alex Wagner was very upset the other night on All In with Chris Hayes about this, that there's a step backwards for women. She almost implied that there was a step backwards for women, that Anthony Weiner's wife is on board with this campaign for mayor. And that it was great that she wasn't at the press conference where he had to confess and so forth and so on. And Chris Hayes seemed to say, if Anthony Weiner was my personal friend and I knew that he was doing this crazy stuff on Twitter and he was married, I would pull him aside physically and say, dude, get your life together, mm-hmm. But I guess my feeling is, again, is that it's that libertarian thing of the fact that he has a little exhibitionist kink that he got caught on with Twitter, and that showed a tremendous hubris and stupidity.
Yes. Houstonity,
But whatever that little kink is of his is really no big deal to me. But lying to Rachel Maddow is a big deal to me.
I know.
In while I was watching it, you know, live, is a big deal. And
it's not the lying. It's not the cover up. It's the lying to Rachel Maddow.
It's the lying to Rachel Maddow.
It really just crosses
makes
that line.
So mad. Yeah. If you're a liberal, you do not lie to Rachel Maddow.
Well, and this actually, I know that people want to have been saying this is the first scandal where nobody got touched, essentially. There was no touchy-touchy. But I remember Jack Ryan, who was Barack Obama's original candidate for senator from Illinois, who was married to 7 of 9, married to Jerry Ryan.
Yeah.
And he took her out to swing clubs.
Yeah, yeah.
And to show off his sexy wife.
And very detailed and scandalous in that she did not like being paraded around like a prostitute.
Exactly.
Which apparently he chose her because of her hotness, mm-hmm. and wanted to do this. And that was...
And wanted to show off.
That was not a good relationship.
No. No. But he had a... He was...
And he disappeared after that. I mean,
he did.
He is nowhere to be seen.
He disappeared. He was on a fast track to becoming a senior senator.
Well, because he was very handsome. He's the right party in the right state.
And he was named Jack Ryan.
He had a gorgeous wife. And
come on. He was Republican. He's from Illinois. And then...
He was a Republican? I thought he was a Democrat.
No, he was Barack Obama's original opponent.
Oh, opponent. Okay, you have me all confused when you said Barack Obama. I thought he was like Barack Obama's choice to replace him. But
No. He was Barack Obama's opponent in the 2004 Senate race.
All right.
Which I actually have a poster of, which I will, probably display in my window. Barack Obama for Senate 2004. And in fact, I'm holding it right now. I'm looking at it right now. It's faded pale blue. Although I have even cooler shit than that, that I should probably, auction off someday for
Ron Paul 2012.
No. Jack Ryan was Barack Obama's opponent, mm-hmm. until someone found out that, I think in his divorce decree, he had been trolling his wife around, and she didn't like that, so they were getting a divorce, and which he dropped out and vanished off the face of the earth and has never been heard again. But there was no actual sex involved in the sex scandal, in the same way that Anthony Weiner, there's no actual sex involved, no penetration, no intercourse, no touchy-touchy involved in the scandal. And the person that they got to replace him was Alan Keyes.
Yeah.
Because
why wouldn't you?
Somewhere a red phone went off and said, quick, get me a black guy.
Yeah, right.
So
black Republican from Illinois who's eligible to run. Yes.
And so they imported Alan Keyes from Maryland, I think, and his gay daughter, who he then repudiated. He just, it ruined so many careers. That race just sort of trashed so many people. But the other cool thing I have is a paper doll cutout book.
Oh, yeah.
Of Newton Leroy Gingrich.
Newt Gingrich paper doll.
Paper doll dress-up book, untouched in its original condition, rather like Superman Volume 1. And from 1994,
which
I think.
Which you don't have. Or we
which
would,
I don't have.
We would be gone.
This podcast would be broadcast
We would still be podcasting, but it would be from the French Riviera.
Yeah, we'd be literally phoning it in from... No, I mean, you've said before what you would do with if you suddenly came into a large, and by large amount of money, we mean $5 we find in the sofa, because at this point, that's a lot of money to us.
Yeah.
But if we came into six figures and more of sudden an infusion of wealth.
Well, we were talking about Powerball. That's what we were talking about. I would want to really get some things on the ballot in every state, like the minimum wage, minimum corporate tax rate, those kind of, let the people decide what should corporations pay, bare minimum. And so I would be changing the world that way. And then I'd also, I think, be buying up houses and rehabbing them in Detroit and making, giving away housing to anyone that wanted housing in Detroit. Mm-hmm. Although I think they're going to do that eventually anyway, but
yeah, There's plenty of good places to spend a chunk of change. I think we also agreed that, you know, we would focus on a couple of congressional races.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really get
at least deeply... call up Howard Dean and get that 50 state strategy going. Yeah, for sure. Because although I have to say, Driftglass, that my contempt of Congress at this point is so high.
I know.
That I really don't have. I'm really not sure what good would come from that if you don't start instituting serious change to the structure of both houses of Congress before you changing personnel. Mm-hmm. Ted Cruz agrees with me, but not quite.
No. Well, he agrees that both sides are wrong. Both sides are because, you know, that David Brooks boat a bag full of centrist wine never goes dry, Lou Gal.
Nope.
There's always plenty to get drunk on in there. It's.
Well, he said he doesn't trust the Republican Party or the Democrat Party because they're all just a bunch of spending politicians. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he's not willing. This is so funny. This is a great story, and we should really just switch to this if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
Wonkette had an article called "Who is John McCain yelling at today?" And pointing out that, you know, like a bad clock, twice a year, John McCain is right. And John McCain got kind of cranky in a good way toward Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and some other Tea Party people, because while they have been whining for months and months about Obama and the democratically controlled Senate not having a budget.
Oh, for years.
Yeah.
For years?
Three years, actually. Now that the Senate has passed a budget, Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and company are running away from naming a committee to the conference committee with the House.
Right.
So that they can actually put their two budgets together. And, you know, the budget that the House passed is the Paul Ryan budget.
Yes.
And so these two budgets are very different.
Yes.
The Democratic controlled Senate, their budget includes tax increases for the wealthy. It includes, as the president would say, a balanced approach between revenue and spending, whereas the House budget is all spending cuts. And so rather than say, okay, you know, we've passed a budget that we're happy with, or the House has passed a budget that we're happy with anyway, and we're going to go ahead and appoint a bipartisan group of senators to work with the House on marking up a conference bill that we will both try to pass, Rand Paul and Ted Cruz have decided that we're going to block naming a committee to work with the House, which is run by Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And McCain has a problem with this. Yeah. He said, we don't trust the majority party on the other side of the Capitol to come to conference and not hold the fiscal discipline that we want to see happen.
Yes.
Is that a little bit bizarre? And Wonkette said, have you met these guys? This is the quote from Wonkette. Good luck trying to talk your intermittent sense through the skulls of these fine fellas. But there does seem to be a one man is an island. Dealing with Ted Cruz.
I'm
holier than everyone here.
This is where I begin my presidential campaign.
Yeah.
So all of my actions are going to be calibrated to making me maximally exciting to the base of the Republican Party.
And to the Glenn Beckites.
Yeah, which is...
Or are not in the base of the quote-unquote Republican.
Which is Rand Paul. I mean, that's Rand Paul. That's Paul Ryan. It's... You got in the door, and there are still... I think I tweeted this morning something about the CDC has pledged to keep a small sample of moderate conservatism on file like they did with smallpox so that future generations can study
what it was.
Yeah. You know, it's like smallpox only jowlier. And really there is still sort of in the seat cushions and tar and nicotine buildup on the walls of the cloakroom, a whiff of the Senate tradition, which I don't particularly like or respect anymore, but was there, that you don't come in here and bring that track, that crazy ass right wing Newt Gingrich bullshit
into the Senate
boys club.
Yes. Into the Senate chamber.
Yeah. I mean, it was a completely royalist attitude.
Understood that the other side is unwashed,
yeah.
But over here we are the House of Lords.
Exactly. And you don't bring that. And now it is. And now it is simply a place for wing nuts to launch their radio careers or their careers in presidential politics or presidential kingmaking. And there is no way to get any business done in the Congress at all, ever, as long as the House is run by yahoos and the Senate is run by people who have to appeal to yahoos to win their next election. And that's where we're at. I mean, that's the civics. So it is amusing that the 812-year-old John McCain is appalled that the Republican Party he has been a part of since he was nine has become that which he has always known it would be. This Ted Cruz is the natural outcropping, the natural outgrowth of the party you helped build. And so is Rand Paul.
Absolutely.
So, prime your fucking river. These are, you know, these are your children, your bastard children, and they have come home and they want their share of the inheritance now. And you don't want to hear it. Well, you know, suck it. You know, welcome to Liberalville, John McCain. This is what it's like to be a liberal for the last 40 years.
And well, and this dovetails very nicely into this whole contempt of Congress, which, as I say, Ted Cruz seems to be banking on that. But Lois Lerner taking the fifth this week. It was fascinating to me to watch those who knew anything about the Constitution and the history of the Fifth Amendment having to defend Lois Lerner's right to do that and point out there's just this learning curve in the media discovering that Daryl Issa is not a federal judge. That this is not a courtroom, that you you have rights and that those rights this wasn't even, first of all, let's be clear. Lois Lerner is a Bush appointee. She's got an awful lot of hubris to just stand there and say she's going to keep her job because, she, as a lot of people have said, she really deserves to be fired just for incompetence. Any manager in any real world job who people screwed up like her people screwed up would be just cut away. But when there is a criminal investigation about to take place, going before Daryl Issa and blabbing is something that any smart attorney is going to tell a client, no, you will not do that. Not that you will incriminate yourself, but everything you say before that committee will be taken apart, read to you in court, redefined before the judge, and you lose control of the narrative that way. So just don't do it. And, you know, Daryl Issa is shocked, I tell you, that he's not the authority over a federal judge or any judge in a real courtroom who's going to really try someone for a criminal wrongdoing.
And he won't.
Or just in an investigation. It may not go to court. Who knows what will happen?
Well, they do show trials. They do. They do show trials and they do them, you know, really well. They'd love to have impeachment hearings. They'd love to have all those. They'd love to have that drama from the 90s back. And that's not coming back. So we'll do the next best thing.
Well, but there's other drama. There's more recent drama than that, which is, you know, Karl Rove refusing to appear before the House Oversight Committee. Because fuck you. And
well, and Bush and Cheney saying, yeah, we'll come, but we can do it in private.
Here's all of our conditions for speaking to you.
And then I will show up for an hour. And they said, okay.
Because
we'll do that.
In reality, having contempt for the House Oversight Committee, which seems to be entirely, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, a political witch hunt committee. And when there's real wrongdoing, it's a good thing to have that.
Well, and there's a lot of, I mean, this I don't want to sweep onto the next topic just yet, but there's a lot of this that my mind just goes to every time when one of these things comes up that, yes, in theory, this is a scandal. In practice, the mechanism by which such scandals are investigated has been so corrupted.
Which scandal are you talking about?
Any scandal.
About?
Any scandal. Any scandal involving the federal government at this point. I think that the AP scandal is a scandal, real genuine scandal. I think the poor Fox News reporter, who is an incompetent reporter but First Amendment hero, should also be thoroughly investigated. I think the IRS situation should be thoroughly investigated.
Well, the Fox News reporter is not going to be charged with anything.
I figured he would. But the mechanism by which these anything like this gets investigated is itself so broken and so corrupt that I simply don't trust. Mm-hmm. And this is a case where, no, I don't trust the Republican Party. I do not trust the GOP to wield power in a way that's responsible, because I fucking lived through the last 40 years. And if you've been politically aware for 20 minutes, you can be as righteous as you like. But I lived through the fucking show trials of the Clinton era. And then I watched the Democratic Party take actual war criminals and say, well, let's put that behind us. Impeachment's not on the table. Let's move on.
Like, well, and we've watched in relation to that AP story, I'm disappointed with myself in that here we have Rachel Maddow and Chris Hayes saying, you know, this AP thing is a really big deal and it will have a chilling effect on anyone trying to connect with an AP reporter who and wanting to release information to them, knowing the government might be listening in on the phone call.
Yeah.
And I get that, but the media has so failed us
worn out, and
I can't raise up enough energy to get mad about this, because as Dave Von Ebers on Facebook said, you know, we need to have freedom of the press so that they can defend the next war like the New York Times.
Yeah. Well, and if I would invite our listeners to go read a post I did yesterday called Frumkin Comes Alive.
Yeah.
Which is, I just reprinted Dan Frumkin's very good, part of his very good informal list for journalists and how journalists should behave, mm-hmm. what they should do. You shouldn't, and I made a few changes to it, but it's basically a very good list. But what it doesn't include is, okay, and what happens when journalists don't follow your rules? Do I get a shield law? Do I get to call myself a journalist? I mean, it was Jeff Gannon a journalist? Is James O'Keefe a journalist? Does he get to be protected? And if that's the case, can Blue Gal, can you whisper completely unsubstantiated slander to me? Mm-hmm. And can I quote you as an anonymous source and print it as fact?
Yep.
And get away with it and say, and if someone ever shows up at my door and says, fuck you, that's, you wrecked my career. You lied about me. I could, no, I'm a journalist.
Yeah.
And I get, see, here's the First Amendment. I am completely protected from that. And single sourcing, anonymous sourcing, as a grossly unjournalistic as that is now a very common practice.
Well, and that added to, that's half of journalism. The other half is, let's cover the both sides controversy.
Yeah.
And protect our little careerist bubble of the DC press corps, regardless of what's actually happening out there.
And speaking of Chris Hayes.
Yeah.
And this, we're hopping around a little bit, but I like where this is going.
Yeah.
Chris Hayes last night, because we do watch him, and we like Chris Hayes. He's very smart. He's a smart young man on TV. So Chris Hayes on television last night was talking about the hypocrisy of the Washington press corps calling people out for their infidelities.
Oh, yeah. And he's been on that before, too.
He said, if you knew, I mean, by God, let me just tell you, if you knew how many of these reporters cheat on their wives and husbands, how frequently they do it.
It's rife with cheating. He said that before on his other show, too.
And my response to him, which he oddly has not replied to my response, which sort of breaks my heart, is, how would I know that the Washington press corps is anything other than angels when you people all protect each other? When you are all dedicated to making sure your colleague's shit never gets aired in public.
Absolutely.
Go after you go after politicians, and you should. You go after corporations not nearly as hard as you should. I don't mean you personally, but you go after the rich and the powerful. This was my only part of my objection to Mr. Frumkin's rules. It was a quibble, really. He kept saying reporters should not take administration word for anything. Mm-hmm. And my quibble is, no, you shouldn't take authority's word for anything. Yeah. Authority means the White House, the Cruz Rand administration in waiting. You shouldn't believe them at all. You should double check everything they do. Corporations and power centers like Rupert Murdoch and Fox News should be assumed to be lying to you, because that is what they are chartered to do. So I am deeply uncomfortable with the fact that Chris Hayes is indignant that this power center, and the Washington Press Corps is a power center, has a lot of shit that it does and gets away with that nobody reports on, because they have this gentleman's agreement and ladies and gentlemen's agreement not to talk about each other's infidelities, even though knowing that Tom Friedman's a billionaire might influence your opinion of him. Knowing
that all of them, everyone sitting in the White House press room, is making enough that it matters to them that there's a grand bargain.
Yes.
Because they don't want to see their payroll taxes go up, and they will, because they're all making over $400,000 a year, mm-hmm. every single person in that room. And that matters, because the agenda of the Washington Press Corps is always now grand bargain for yes. everyone from Morning Joe to right down to the people in AP who are sitting in that room with Jay Carney. Are all pushing grand bargain because it affects their paycheck.
Mm-hmm. Personally.
Personally.
And so, Chris,
and no one ever talks about that except
us. If you want to be in, Chris, I don't have a TV show or a staff or press credentials or access to the Washington Press Corps, but you do. So if you want to be indignant about how hypocritical your colleagues are, I've written 270 posts about David Gregory and never met the man. He's your colleague, and he puts liars and slanderers and criminals and lunatics and Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld on television.
Don Rumsfeld sell his book. Yes.
And I've never heard you whisper a fucking peep about that. Mm-hmm. And that really bothers me, because David Gregory is, and I realize he has a much bigger office than you and is much higher up the food chain, and you both share the name NBC and all those things. But if you really want to be the reporter that I think you want to be, you have to include in your circle, because you have no problem naming Ted Cruz, naming Rand Paul, talking specifically about people who did certain things and being very, very clear about who those people are and what they did. But this sort of blanket indictment of the mainstream media and the press corps is...
Well, although I think Chris Hayes is probably pushing right up to the edge of what he's allowed to do before he's sent back to The Nation magazine as a co-reporter.
Well, and there we go.
So
and there we go.
That.
And you know. And I also want to say two more things about the IRS scandal, just apropos of nothing. The first is, it is hilarious to me that the reaction of the Bush appointee is, fuck you, I've been here 8 years. Yes, I might be responsible for it. I did nothing wrong. Bite my ass. Mm-hmm. And the reaction from the Obama appointee, who'd been there 5 minutes, is, I take full responsibility and I quit.
Well, no, let's be clear. The Obama appointee, who was not appointed by the Congress,
he's an acting
IRS.
Because they couldn't get...
Get it approved. So
through
he quits.
This Congress.
He quits before he's put into office as an actual IRS head.
Yeah.
Because the Republican Congress will, the senators, mm-hmm. Republican senators will not approve any Obama appointees.
So the Bush appointee is.
And then Obama says, I want to work with the Congress.
Yeah. The reaction of the Bush appointee is, take the responsibility and deny everything, even though you were there.
Just sit there. Yeah.
You were there during the scandal. Yeah. The reaction of the Obama appointee or attempted appointee or acting appointee is, even though I had nothing to do with this, I take responsibility for it and I fall on my sword.
Yep.
So, well, okay, there's that. The second is, I'm going to give Ms. Lerner the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. I have worked at companies where the middle management, especially of the software maintenance department, not the development department. Those people all went on vacation the minute their projects were over. And the projects were always over on time and on budget, because they'd always put shit into production that was broken and wrong.
And they don't care.
And they don't care, because, budgets, we're done with the budget and it's time to put it in production. So fuck it. It's done. I'm going to Egypt for a month.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they do. And that's how they kept their department on time and on budget.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, their shit would be going completely nuclear, taking down the entire company every night, week after week, because it sucked. It was never tested. It was awful. That fell to the maintenance guys. That would be me
mm-hmm.
and my crew, who also had budgets. And we were constantly being reamed out for
being over budget.
All this overtime. Why are you coming in? Why is all this overtime? And the people who did nothing but read the budgets saw one team behaving really, really well and one team behaving really, really profligately and wanted to know what was wrong with that other team. Mm-hmm. And our point was, you keep screwing us and cutting our resources and getting rid of people we need, all the while increasing our workload. And we've been telling you this for years, and now it's finally broken. You want to beat me up over it? Fuck you.
Yep.
So...
But
I
want me in at 3 a.m. if their system crashes every single time.
You don't want to hold the people who are actually causing this problem to account for what they do, because they look good on paper. But you want me to fix their problems, but do it as
an unpaid intern?
Essentially, yes. As an unpaid, you want me and my expert team to fix their problems.
Yeah.
at half the cost that it actually costs to fix the problem. And when I can't make that 10 pounds of shit fit in a 5-pound bag, you want to blame me for being a bad manager. And that was the back and forth that a lot of us had with this company for many years. Now, look, if the IRS, this office of the IRS is as badly screwed as I think they are, mm-hmm. if they really have been losing employees, getting cutbacks, being asked to do much, much more with much, much less, and along the line, people were saying, look, we can't do this work. We are overwhelmed. We're drowning here. And all you're giving us is more work and smaller budgets. What the fuck do you expect us to do? They're probably being told by someone slightly up the higher food chain, deal with it. And so if I were putting up with that for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, and it just kept getting worse and worse and worse, and finally Congress decides to haul me in front of it and say, why did you screw up so badly, you bitch? Mm-hmm. My inclination might be, fuck you, I'm taking the Fifth, and you can bite my shiny metal ass on the way out of here. Mm-hmm. So I kind of feel for people who are being asked to do way too much by people who take no responsibility for dumping on them. And then when they fail at lift, you know, they give them a ton to lift. They can only hoist half a ton, which is a miracle in and of itself, but they want to beat them up for the other half ton that they can't possibly ever have lifted and no human being could. That is my major gripe with how government employees generally are treated, which is you are asking them to do – same thing with teachers. You're asking teachers to do – to defend your children during tornadoes.
Right, right.
To save your children during gunfights. Mm-hmm. To teach them – to be decent citizens, to teach them to grow up to be productive citizens, to handle their disabilities and their social problems.
And just simply resolve the issue of children and poverty all by themselves.
All by themselves.
Yep.
And you're asking them to do that while, you know, and those children come home in the middle of the year and ask if I could have a ream of paper because we don't have any more paper in our classroom.
Right, right.
We don't have any more pencils in our classroom. We ran out. Do we have any pencils I could bring to school? Mm-hmm. And the people who do that work year after year after year get treated like shit and called union thugs by these assholes. Mm-hmm. And then they want to know why their problems aren't being solved. Yeah. And they want to blame those people for the failures of society. No, I have no time for people who want to treat government employees as their personal servants to be kicked around. And then when they kick back finally, they get all indignant.
They're thugs, yes.
How dare you? How dare you ask for that? Oh, my God. So I'm going to give her, at least in my imagination, the benefit of some doubt. But let's move on to weather weapons, shall we?
That tornado was a weapon, according to Alex Jones. I didn't even want to give Alex Jones any time on this podcast,
no.
So I'm done. But
no,
the story is, as Rachel Maddow's pointed out, is that there are Congress people who pick up Alex Jones' talking points and bring them into the halls of Congress.
Yes.
So
and it shows the lesson from Anthony Weiner, for me, is not Anthony Weiner. The lesson from Anthony Weiner is the city of New York currently has 8.245 million people living in it. Mm-hmm. Apparently, the only people who are able to run for mayor is Anthony Weiner.
Right, right.
And four other guys. And if you and I wanted to run for it, we could never do it. It says a lot about what being in that club means. It means you're never, ever out of favor. Yeah. You might be out of the spotlight, but you can make four, five, six phone calls and become a viable candidate.
Yep.
Just like that, because you've got money shooting out of your ass.
Access. Yep.
And what weather weapons tells me is it's not about that single stupid conspiracy. It's about people who begin with the premise that Barack Obama or the Democratic Party are an occupying illegitimate government.
And that there's been Alex Joneses throughout world history.
Yeah.
Let's be clear. This is not something new.
And they always
conspiracy theorists have always been around. And, you know, there's got to be some greater evil power behind everything.
That's, some of them invent whole religions.
Yeah.
But if the idea that you take every crisis, and this you just see this with conservatives constantly, and frankly, you see it with some of the Stand with Rand people, is every crisis is an opportunity to reason backwards from your from your basic paranoid theory of how the world is into how did Barack Obama engineer this tornado? Because it must be him. How did gay people cause a hurricane? Because it must be them. And it's the predictability.
It's the gay Boy Scouts that started the tornado in Oklahoma. You know that, right?
Oh, yeah. That's clearly off. And it's the predictability of that reaction. I want to
say two things about Oklahoma. First of all, obviously, our thoughts are with everyone there. And I want to thank everyone who sent kind words to me about my sisters. They're both, I talked to one of them yesterday, and they're both hanging in there. And this podcast is not going to become a weekly update about their health. They are doing okay. But I want to thank everyone who has sent kind words to me. One in particular said that I'm an atheist and I don't pray, but I'm sending all these good wishes. I said, it's all good.
Yeah.
You know, it's all good. So
it all matters.
It all matters and it all makes a difference. And thank you. The Oklahoma Senate, however, while this week has been going on.
Mm-hmm. You think they'd be busy this week, wouldn't you, Blue Gal?
You think they'd be busy trying to help.
Have their hands full.
Tornado people.
Mm-hmm.
But the Oklahoma State Senate passed a bill that would defund Planned Parenthood.
Of course.
And this Senate bill passed by a vote of 33-8. The state Senate was able to pass the bill somewhat under the radar.
Because the radar was blown down by a tornado.
Blown down by a tornado. Mm-hmm. And they had not posted this bill on their agenda for the day.
No.
So in addition to being Planned Parenthood defunders, they're fucking cowards.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
That does come from HuffPo. And I'm just so disgusted with these people.
I'm tired of the predictability of it. I'm really tired of those waves never going anywhere.
You're listening to the Professional Left Podcast, professionalleft.blogspot.com. We are doing 10 more minutes today to respond to a couple things. One is Barack Obama's speech yesterday afternoon, which had not happened when we were recording yesterday.
We were busy writing it for him, so.
Yeah, right. Two things. One is about the Code Pink Medea Benjamin. The fact that she was heard, I think, is important.
Yeah.
And hopefully she can be heard more without having to interrupt and yell. Maybe they can sit down and have a little talk. That'd be nice. It'd be nice if he invited her to a beer summit.
Well, he sat down with Tom Friedman and Jeffrey Gold. Yes, he did. He absolutely
You're kidding.
Did. After that meeting.
Oh.
After that meeting.
He did not.
Yes, he did.
For real?
After that meeting, he had a meeting with Fred Hyatt, Jeffrey Goldberg, Tom Friedman, and a few others, which I just read about this.
You are fucking kidding me.
Nope. Nope. Security.
I did not know that.
Yeah. No, I just it's on Politico, which makes me feel dirty just saying that.
I agree.
I just tossed up at my millionth. There's a club. You're not in it post this morning because, yeah, he had a, you know, and last week it was Ezra Klein and Josh Marshall and other progressive bloggers who, you know, live in that area code, I guess.
Right.
But yeah, right after the meeting, he had a meeting with all. Well, and you can see the trend. He wants to sort of line up the op-ed column.
He's doing what he does, which is line up all of the interested parties. Well, and he must have either sat down with or in some way contacted or interfaced with the ACLU, because they had, for the most part, kind things to say about his speech today. There's a couple problems that they still have. Where, for instance, you know, people, he's willing to release everyone who has cleared the threshold, you know, in Guantanamo. But what do we do with those people that have not cleared the threshold? And there are, you know, real concerns about this court that just sort of put them in jail forever. And obviously the ACLU says, look, don't try to move the process by which these people were locked up indefinitely to the United States, because that will not work. So, but there, I feel like there is a conversation going on now about that's important, and that is, fortunately, at least for now, outside the purview of the House Oversight Committee.
And out here in the fields where we fight for our meals, to quote The Who, if you don't mind. This conversation has been going on for a long time.
Yeah, right. It's been going on in the left-wing blogosphere for a really long time.
For a really, really long time. And I just want to underscore, if you're an absolute cynic and there's nothing that can ever be done and everything is only ever going to get worse forever, then you just scroll on past this part of the podcast.
Right.
I don't know if anything will come of this. I don't know if it'll work itself out. But I do know that we on the left, I'm speaking of me very specifically, said during the Bush administration, this is going to take a generation to undo. Because so much stuff is being broken that it's going to take a generation to undo the damage.
Still going on.
My point is, we're not into, you know, we're a couple of years into that generation that it's going to take to unwind that. We really screwed up an awful lot of basic functioning.
We still are, Driftglass. We still are. Perhaps not in this arena, but in terms of the environment and in terms of the economy, we're still screwing it up.
Oh, what I'm saying is I'm focusing specifically on this speech, on illegal detention, on Guantanamo, on droning people, on conducting secret wars forever and ever. It's going to take. We weren't kidding when we said it's going to take one hell of a long time. There's going to be an awful lot of backsliding. Every time you think you make progress, you're going to, you know, there'll be the crushing disappointment of your leadership letting you down.
Yeah.
And it's going to take a hell of a long time to fix all the shit that's been broken. And it's still being broken. I hope that this speech was a signal that some portion of all the terrible things that need to be cleaned up is we're at least heading in the right direction. I don't know. I've been disappointed before. I think everyone in politics should fall madly in love with a candidate and get their heart broken.
Yeah.
I think that's mandatory to join the club.
Yes.
And then you get over that and you realize it's a business.
Yeah.
You're hiring an employee to fix something or to do something. And we want to hire employees who don't make things worse at the very least. So I took it as a little tiny green shoot of hope.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if it's any more than that. I thought it was incredibly deft as a speaker to weave into your closing remarks the heckler.
Yeah.
In your own audience.
Well, and she wasn't actually a heckler as much as a protester, but yes.
And that's sort of is what democracy is supposed to look like. You know, democracy. You know, if there had been 100 of her all screaming at the top of their lungs about his birth certificate, no. That's not what democracy looks like. That's what a mob looks like. But having someone in the audience who stands up and says their piece and won't sit down until their piece is heard because nobody – and one of the really good points that was raised all over the hypercritical, very critical side of the left, which are completely valid, is these are the questions that the Washington Press Corps should have been asking all along.
Yeah.
And they didn't, and they weren't, and they never were. And, you know, that's sort of what you're supposed to be doing, guys. And the reason we don't like you very much and the reason you won't see us rising very rapidly to your defense sometimes is that you don't do the job you're supposed to do.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Anyway.
And I want to thank Pope Francis for reading my blog all these years, Not Atheists.
Yeah.
Because that's pretty much all I got to say.
A lot of people might not have heard what Pope did.
Yeah. Pope Francis said that there is a commandment to do good and that atheists who do good will be encountered with the faithful, so to speak, that that the faithful Catholics can meet the atheist at the point of doing good.
Yeah.
Which is an indication that atheists are all right, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of what he's saying, which is going to freak out not just Catholics. It's going to freak out a lot of people for whom believing that accepting certain doctrine opens gates for you is a place of safety. And I'm trying to be very fair in how I put this. I tend to think that borders on intolerance and we have to be careful about that. But different people believe different things. But I'm just grateful that the Pope, this Pope, you know, and that's the thing. There'll be a different Pope some other day.
Yeah.
We've had Ratzinger and...
Mm-hmm.
You know, the relevance of the Pope is another story for another day. So
yeah. And
if you look up atheist at my blog, you'll find a lot of writing that I've done in the past 8 years about atheists getting into heaven before I do, because they don't have the carrot or the stick of religion to be at that place of doing good. So, well, I want you to know, Dirkless, I saw driving middle child to school the other day.
Uh-huh.
The car in front of me had not only Unitarian clergy and faith is something, something, the faith and peace and such bumper stickers, but a Darwin sticker as well.
Yeah.
all on the same car. And mm-hmm. she was, the mom was Unitarian clergy.
Mm-hmm.
So there are churches and places where you can find community and not have to adopt specific theology, if that's your thing. So good for all of us, and very grateful for the separation of church and state.
I'd also say that my work corrupting the children in this regard goes on. Mm-hmm. A middle child had a project that she brought home. It's the end of the school year now. On Galileo, and it was a time. Part of it was a timeline. Here's Galileo's life. Here's where he was born, and here's where he got his first telescope, and here's where he was jailed, and so on and so forth. But I said jokingly, "Well, you left one of the dates off of your timeline," and she's a very serious student and wanted to know what that date was. I said, "The point 400 years after he died, when the Catholic Church finally admitted that they were wrong." And let him out of the penalty box. And that prompted a discussion about, well, what do you mean? I said, well, it took the Catholic Church literally centuries to admit they were wrong about the earth being the center of the universe and acknowledge that they had gotten why did it take them so long? Well, when your entire religion is based on the guy in charge never being wrong, you can never admit error or the entire thing starts to fall apart.
Right.
And that is a kind of and that's a very comforting mindset for people. And you can understand why they'd want to be certain, why they'd want to sort of see the world in as a chair and a table. They're stable. You sit at them. They're there. They don't change. They don't move. And you look up at the sky and you see the sun going by. And it's really easy to believe that you're not going anywhere and everything's going around you. But it's really important that when you get things wrong, you figure out a way to change your mind. When the facts change,
right?
Because if you don't, you end up really, really going a little bit crazy, and you end up devoting a lot of your energy to defending positions that are indefensible. And we talked about the microscope and germs, and you know that there's no germs.
There's
in the Bible.
There's no germs in the Bible. I know you said that to me, right?
And then evolution, and you know how tied up in knots people, and it really baffled her that people wouldn't. Well, okay, once you know something isn't true, why do you keep believing it? Well, that's a good discussion. So
it's a good discussion. Youngest child was asking me about Jesus this morning,
mm-hmm.
and she couldn't figure out why some people thought Jesus is God. And so I talked with her about it. I said, well, not everyone believes that. And she said, what? And I would not tell her. I would not go into it as far as telling her what to believe about that, because theology is all over the map on that one. And she has to come to her own conclusion.
Huh?
But I did talk to her about the Bible verse that said, I and my Father are one. And I said, but does that mean you're one person if you're one with somebody else or not? And she said, well, maybe it does, but maybe it doesn't. And she just went off on this, you know, what could that mean? Could that be poetic? Could that be literal? And what the difference between being literal and using poetry to say something? And we had a wonderful conversation about it. But I will not, on questions like that, and for instance, also, where do we go when we die? I will not train my children to believe one thing over another. I just won't do it. Each week, we post to our Facebook page and website an Internet Kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's Internet Kitty is Rocky, and Rocky had to be Photoshopped for your viewing pleasure because Rocky was very camouflaged on the chair that Rocky was sitting on. So we toyed with it a little bit, but it is Rocky on that chair.
Really?
And he's at our Facebook page and website, professionalleft.blogspot.com. You can send your Internet Kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you, first of all, Driftglass is blocking my script.
I'm sorry.
We use Google Docs, and when Driftglass moves his cursor around the script that we're both looking at our respective computers, he covers up my what I want to say. Even though I say this every week, I'd like to read it.
What I was doing was asserting the power of the patriarchy.
I see. Right.
You will read what I tell you to read.
I see.
See?
And then I'll just delete you when we're after the podcast is recorded.
Oh, that's
I'll just take it out.
I screwed with my sound editor. That was that was my first mistake.
Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service, and we have been corrected. It is Go Postal Unions, plural. There is more than one postal union out there. Letter on the air unless you say otherwise. We don't care which postal union it is. We want them to go. Postal unions. All right. Mm-hmm. Rah, rah. So, Driftglass.
Yeah.
How are the Internet Kiddies doing this week?
Oh, Blue Gal, the Internet Kiddies are forming their own 501c4 blogger ethics panel.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional F Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2013, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast. We have had a bit of dry up, and I know people are in their gardens and vacationing and so forth. So we may be taking a respite from the Stump the Chump 9 billion names of pod.
This week is called Science Fiction University.
Science Fiction University, or Shut the Fuck Up, right?
SFU, right.
But I find on the internet a Robert Heinlein quiz.
Oh, Lord.
10 questions about Robert Heinlein, and I can make them
multiple choice
if you need them to be, but I think in many cases you won't.
Okay.
All right, question one. What does the A stand for in Heinlein's name?
Hey, how would I know that? Anson.
That's right.
Yes. Thank you.
Another easy one. What branch of the military did Robert Heinlein serve in?
The U.S. Navy.
That's right. Uh-huh. Question three, what year did Heinlein publish his first short story?
I got this one wrong, I have to admit. Can I cheat one little bit I know he published it as a result of a contest.
Mm-hmm.
He had been medically discharged from the Navy because of lungs, had lung problems. And his wife and small child had to eat, and he had no job. And I believe he saw this writing contest, entered it, and then realized that the guy across the street, metaphorically, would actually pay him more than the contest was worth. So went over there to John Campbell and published it. So it was probably 1945, 48, something like that.
That's what I thought. I thought it was 44. I thought it was post-war, but it was 1939.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
One of his stories was about, and this makes sense because one of his stories was about the atom bombing of Nazi Germany as a method of ending the war, except it wasn't an atom bomb. I believe they used fallout.
Oh.
It basically dusted the city, but that was all completely classified shit that he and his science dork friends just knew about because they knew physics.
Yeah.
And they speculated about the possibility of a weapon. So I retroactively withdraw my answer and would like to reiterate 1938.
1939.
See?
You're still wrong.
I'm still wrong. Even when I'm told the answer, I get it wrong. Yeah.
Question four.
Yeah.
And there's a trick to this question. You just have to listen very carefully.
Okay.
Not counting posthumous awards. That's important.
Yeah.
How many Hugo Awards did Heinlein win in his lifetime, not counting posthumous awards?
Nine.
Four.
Four? He was robbed of those others. Yes, he was robbed of those others, yes.
Question five.
Uh-huh.
Heinlein also won Science Fiction's Nebula Award.
Yes.
How many did he win? And the answer is not none. He did win.
Three.
That was my answer, too. He only won it one time.
Oh, that's ridiculous. Yeah. Well, Hugo's are voted by the Science Fiction Writers of America. You have to be a member.
Mm-hmm.
And Nebulas are voted by, like, the general science fiction folks specifically. Oh. One is sort of a Academy Award, you got to be an Academy member. One is a much more general award, but it's weird. I'm sure he got a Grandmaster Award after he died, or maybe before. I'm mucking this up badly, but they didn't start really handing out awards until sort of after he had his heyday. They were handing them out, but they weren't really, you know, formalized in a thing until, by the way, Hugo Award, named for Hugo Gernsback.
There you go.
Thank you.
So, all right, question six. What publisher published most of Heinlein's juvenile novels? Was it Bantam, Scribner's, Doubleday, or McGraw-Hill?
I want to say, what are my four choices again?
Bantam, Scribner's, Doubleday, McGraw-Hill.
I want to say Doubleday.
Nope, Scribner's.
Scribner's.
All right, question seven.
Ask me John Campbell, and I'll tell you the answer.
Question seven. Which of the books was not written by Robert Heinlein?
Oh, no! Okay.
And I got this one wrong, too. Number one, Double Star. Number two, Starman Jones. Number three, Time for the Stars. And number four, The Stars Are Ours.
Four.
That's right. Very good.
Thank you.
Okay. Here's another easy one that I got wrong. But you won't. Which Heinlein bestseller added the word grok to the vocabulary of many science fiction fans?
That would be Stranger in a Strange Land.
Very good.
Yes.
Very good.
A good book, by the way. It still holds up.
Question nine is a multiple choice. What do the Heinlein works Red Planet and Stranger in a Strange Land have in common? Number one, both won a Hugo Award. Number two, both won a Nebula Award. Number three, both have a hero with the same first name. And number four, both are set on the planet Mars.
It can't be four because Stranger in a Strange Land largely takes place on Earth. So set on the planet Mars would be misleading.
Oh, well, see, that's it. That is the answer, though.
Oh, see?
This quiz.
See?
So,
no.
Dear quiz. Both did not win a Hugo or a Nebula. And both do not have a hero with the same first name. So interesting, though, that you could actually argue that Stranger in a Strange Land actually mostly takes place on Earth.
Almost entirely does. It's Mars is referenced a few times, but it is almost entirely set on.
All right. Well, we'll have to write to the author of this quiz and say, liar.
Dear Virginia Heinlein.
Liar. Question 10. This is the last one.
Okay.
And I could give it to you as a multiple choice, but let's start with multiple choice.
Nah, no net.
What was the last book Heinlein published before his death?
Friday.
No, although that was one of the choices. The other three choices are The Cat Who Walked Through Walls, To Sail Beyond the Sunset, and the third one is I Will Fear No Evil.
It wasn't I Will Fear No Evil. No. It wasn't Grumbles from the Grave because he was dead. So I'd have to go with To Sail Beyond the Sunset.
You are correct. All right. You really do know your Heinlein pretty well.
I sort of do. Those were adequate questions.
Yeah. Some of them were very easy for you, obviously. But good. Only got 40% right when I took the quiz online. I'm not a Heinlein aficionado as you are.
Not a science fiction fan like me. Like I'm trying to convert everyone into.
You're doing a good job.
Well, I try.
All right. Do you have any? If someone wanted to start reading science fiction this summer, for their summer reading, and we're talking beach reading here, okay?
Yeah.
What books would you recommend to someone who is reading?
It's a tricky question because there are people who will not see movies if they're black and white.
Yeah.
Even though they're awesome.
Yeah.
I, for one, still have a problem with silent movies. And I know that there's some wonderful silent movies out there. I just can't make my brain sit still for a silent movie. I barely can do it. I think I saw The Black Pirate, which was fine, and a few others, but there are things that I think are worth reading that almost no one below a certain age will read. So I would probably go for topics Like, what interests you? There was a this back and forth on the internets this week, as there is many weeks, about the coming collapse of the jobs market because of robotics.
Mm-hmm.
And learned tech roboticists discussing the, you know, we as roboticists and cyberneticists have to take this seriously because it's these automated creatures are coming not just for manufacturing jobs, but they're going to be able to do the jobs of lawyers and doctors. And what happens when you can displace pretty much the entire middle class
mm-hmm.
with machines? And isn't it about time that, you know, some of us started talking about that? And that just sort of made me laugh because, well, yeah, that would be good. Or you could read what Jack Williamson was writing 60 years ago. Or you could read what Kurt Vonnegut was writing in the 1950s, Player Piano, which is a very good book. So you could read Player Piano. If there's a particular topic that interests you, I would go, for example, if the future of automation and human interaction with machines interests you, I'd start with Asimov.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked a couple of short stories by Isaac Asimov. If dystopian universes interest you and reality not being what it seems to be interest you, I'd start with a collection of short stories by Robert Heinlein called The Unpleasant Profession of Jonathan Hogue. And there was a story in it called Them or They, which was written, you know, in the 40s,
mm-hmm.
which really prefigures all of Philip Dick, which in turn prefigures about half of the science fiction movies out today.
Well, and I would differ with you, actually, on that. If someone likes dystopian fiction, I would go with Margaret Atwood.
Oh, see, that's an excellent choice.
Yeah.
Excellent choice. If you want, see, I think that's actually a better choice than the one.
Yeah, for a summer read that will get you really involved in a book. Oryx and Crake is fantastic, and the audiobook of that is really well read. So I'm afraid I can't remember who read it, but.
And if you want to cry, I mean, you know,
I love to cry.
If you want stuff that'll make you sad, mm-hmm. I generally like the sort of, I don't know what to call it, a little more sort of adventure fiction,
mm-hmm.
not pirates, but there's, you know, I grew up on science fiction writers who weren't really good with the genitalia and the emotions. You know, people say, and they're quite right, if you took all gender references out of Isaac Asimov, you couldn't tell the men from the women.
Yeah.
And that's a flaw. That's not an endearing trait. That's an actual flaw in the literature that endured for a long time. I would go with Octavia Butler.
Yeah. Yeah. She's hard to read. You handed something to me. Yeah. The parable of the sower is just
parable of the sower is really hard to read. It's
too
really
depressing.
And she really worked hard on that book, and she really tried.
It's a well written book, and
it's beautifully written.
Part of it that I read, I mean, there's a very strong religious angle to it.
Yeah.
It should be right up my alley, and it's just sad.
It's one of the, and I have, I don't know about you, but I have certain movies that are good that I haven't seen yet because I'm like, you know what? I don't think I need a cup full of depression this week.
Yeah.
And that's what this, it's a really well-told sad story about tragic endings and outcomes and everybody dies.
Yeah.
And you know what? No, I think I need something other than that in my sloshing around in my brain this week.
It's interesting that both Oryx and Crake and the Octavia Butler one that you just mentioned, what's it called again?
Parable of the Sower.
Parable of the Sower. Mm-hmm. One of the things that comes up in both of those books is lack of water.
Absolutely.
And
yep.
How you preserve water over even when you know there's a use for it. It's fascinating to me that what happened, you know, that's life.
Mm-hmm.
Water is life. And so that's something that kind of crops up in both these books. Anyway.
And Octavia Butler I love reading her stuff. I used to. She passed away many years ago, which was very sad. She was a brilliant writer. Beautiful voice. I heard her read in public once. Beautiful, rich, sort of baritone woman's voice that was just gorgeous. Fill up a whole room. Very shy person. Terrific writer. But
And she's African-American, right?
Yeah, she's African-American. one of the very few science fiction writers who's African-American. And she wrote about the moral complexity. This is why I don't mean to say, and here's why I like black writers. But she wrote about science fiction the way Ta-Nehisi Coates writes about politics and culture. That it's complicated. Yeah. It's really complicated. Mm-hmm. And you have to be very careful about judging people. And the sins are real, but they manifest themselves in ways that are tricky to talk about.
Yeah.
You know, she sort of subsumed this into science fiction to some degree, and she would have, you know, alien species that take over the Earth and depend on human beings to essentially as breeding incubators for their children.
Mm-hmm.
So there's slavery,
mm-hmm.
but there's also nanny and child relationships. Mm-hmm. And there's also an acknowledgement in her time travel novel that all of the people you know today, almost without exception in America, if they've been here for 6, 7, 8 generations, especially if they're African American, have heritages that mix slaveholders and rapists with slaves.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to come to terms with the fact your ancestry, my ancestry, everybody, pretty much everybody who lives here is so broken and corrupt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of like, that's how human beings have been doing this for a long time. And writing eloquently about that and saying, yes, there's evil in the world. But when you trace your lineage back, don't be shocked if you find a slaveholder.
Yeah, you're not untouched.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
And anyway, that's it. So I like her because, and maybe we should just do a show about that over the summer, the books that made us cry.
Yeah. Or books that we love. Yeah.
Books that moved us emotionally or movies that moved us emotionally.
That'd be good.
Yeah, because Star Trek was good.
But I haven't seen it yet, so shut up.
All I'm going to say is if you – it is clear that the filmmaker has something to say about Osama bin Laden drones at 9/11 and doesn't exactly hide his light under a bushel of special effects.
No.
So anyway, there's that. So, but that the movie, it's fun to watch, but it doesn't move me emotionally in any particular way. It doesn't make me think. I don't go home afterwards and go, you know, I wonder what – I'm infuriated or bemused or vexed by something that I've seen. Mm-hmm. So anyway – moving on.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
This was good.